Hello and welcome to Bondcast, a podcast series where we discuss our views on the latest themes and events shaping rates markets. I'm Imogen Bakra, Head of Non-Dollar Rate Strategy, and I'm joined today by our Global Market Specialists, Dan Navruzzi and Joanne Spadigan. Okay, as usual, we're recording this on Thursday, straight after the ECB, so I think that's probably the best place to start. We were very much in line with consensus and expecting no change to the policy rate today, which is, of course, what was delivered. But we were focused very much on, I suppose, their forward guidance, any indications they gave around the timing of that policy easing. And one of the things we were looking at closely to kind of understand that timing was also the updated macroeconomic projections. So, Joanne, why don't you just talk us through, you know, the kind of key takeaways from today's meeting?
So there was a lot of focus this meeting on the inflation projections, which, as you will have known, we have expected those to come down for a while, and energy really being one of the key reasons why the ECB would have to revise lower its inflation forecast. And that's exactly what they did. We had gone into this meeting actually expecting that the ECB might not revise their inflation forecast down as much as we thought inflation would look like. But it seems like the ECB has actually marked to market their inflation forecast at this point, which was a bit of a surprise and actually a little bit dovish for that reason. So they now see inflation at 2.3% in 2024, 2% in 2025, and 1.9% in 2026. So there's a fairly big drop in the inflation projections, but also what was interesting that was that core inflation for 2026 also was put in as 2%. So I think overall, mildly dovish set of projections, but given what we expected, but more or less in line with our expectations and market pricing as well. I think for markets, there are two key takeaways in terms of the timing and the amount of cuts expected. The ECB has again continued to guide towards June as being the time where they expect the first rate cuts to come. They've said today that they will have some data in April, but only have as much data as they would want it by June. So again, really putting the onus on the data to help them kick out rates and saying that that data only comes in June. So that narrative of a summer cut is still very much live and very much in line with what they're saying for today as well. The other thing that they were asked as well was on market pricing and how that looks versus their expectations. And they've said that the markets are converging towards their view. So I do think that is in line with our expectation that actually 100 basis points or around that much looks fairly fair for cuts this year. I think, you know, taking a range of a cut every other meeting from June onwards of 25 basis points or a cut every meeting from June of 25 basis points puts us between at 100 basis points in between that range. So I think that's fair for now. The other interesting point is, of course, they keep talking about not having to follow the Fed and the ECB, of course, being sensitive to the Fed, but not necessarily using that as an indication of when to go. And I think, of course, that's the narrative that they will push. But perhaps the thing that's stopping them from cutting earlier, especially given the forecast that we've got today, is perhaps the Fed as well.
In terms of timing, then, of course, we didn't always have, but in the last couple of weeks, we've had June as our central scenario for the first rate cut. We'd previously been looking for that to be a bigger size cut, 50 basis points, just based on this idea that if they were going a little bit later, when the data, you know, arguably might already suggest they should be easing rates, and they might just go in bigger increments. Have you changed your central scenario there after today's meeting?
No, so we've not changed our central scenario. So our base case is still for a 50 basis points cut in June. I think, you know, the inflation data from today and the projection that they have clearly are in line with this idea that they should have perhaps gone earlier than June, given where inflation is at this point. So we're not changing that 50 basis points cut. I think, you know, the balance of risks the risks are balanced at this stage. And we've obviously got data to come in the next few months that will help to determine what that level for the first rate cut is, and the Fed will also be an important component there. But I think, like global central banks, it's not just about headline inflation. Of course, I think the underlying wage pressures and service price inflation will, of course, also be watched by the ECB. And if those are moderating quicker, I think, you know, the chance of a cut, perhaps a bigger cut, even increases at that point.
Okay, that makes sense. And then finally, of course, as we kind of approach spring, as you can see in the sky behind me for anyone watching, the time is upon us for the conclusion of the ECB's operational framework review. Did we have any news on that today?
So the ECB has now given us a specific date that we should be watching. And interestingly, it was the same date given to us by sources a couple of weeks ago. So the 13th of March will be the day where the operational framework does conclude. And they've said that communications will come soon after. And we expect that will be on the 13th of March. So definitely keep an eye out there. And just as a reminder for those who hadn't listened before, our key assumption there is that they do adopt a Bank of England style approach to managing reserves, so a demand-driven framework, where we think that one option that the ECB could adopt actually is a shift lower in the MRO rate. So the marginal refinancing operations rate is currently at deposit facility plus 50, which offers 1 week liquidity to banks, and that we think that could be shifted lower as part of the review. But there's a lot more detail and more to come, I think, on the 13th of March. So moving now into the UK, it's also been an incredibly busy week in the UK with the spring budget this week. So Imogen, what did we learn from the budget that came yesterday on Wednesday?
I guess the short answer is not a huge amount. It was a budget that came very much in line with consensus, both in terms of announced policies and then also what that implies for the borrowing needs and how that borrowing will be split across the curve. Perhaps a budget that comes without fireworks is a nice welcome relief to the UK market that has obviously had lots of fireworks in fiscal events over the last couple of years. So in that context, it was relatively boring. The key measures had obviously already been leaked, the kind of headline measure with the 2p cut to national insurance, but also with the fuel duty exemption and the non-dom tax status as well. So they were broadly in line with expectations. The headroom that Chancellor Hunt was left with was slightly larger than we had been expecting. He announced headroom of about $9 billion over the five-year projection horizon. But that was largely driven by slightly more optimistic GDP projections by the OBR. You know, they had 0.8% of GDP growth in 2024 and 1.9% of GDP growth in 2025, which compares to Bloomberg consensus, let's say, of 0.4, so half that in 2024 and just 1.2 in 2025. So that sort of slightly better headroom number, if you like, was underpinned by lofty, I would say, growth forecast, which perhaps beg the question, you know, or remind us which way the skew of risks are should those growth forecasts not materialize. But overall, a very boring budget. In terms of the gilt remit, that number came almost exactly in line with consensus. Gross borrowing needs via gilts will be $265 billion next year. We were the kind of median number in most of the surveys that I saw in the run-up to the budget, expecting $258 billion. And of course, you know, we've discussed on this pod before about how we expected the DMO to use this budget to, or use this gilt remit to, marginally skew the issuance shorter down the curve. And that too came almost in line with expectations in terms of cutting the longs bucket and shifting that into the mediums.
And what is the takeaway for markets from all of this and from the renewed gilt numbers, I suppose?
So I think the immediate market reaction was really one of relief, but that goes back to, like I say, the experience of the UK of previous fiscal events, I think, and the way that we saw the skew of risks, I suppose, in terms of being to the upside when it came to the borrowing numbers. But I think just to view a budget that comes in line with expectations as one that's particularly market friendly is probably missing the kind of bigger picture here that like I said, this is a budget where the borrowing numbers are based on the premise of quite optimistic growth forecasts, and therefore the near-term risk to those borrowing numbers feels skewed to the upside if those optimistic growth forecasts don't materialize. But also that one of the big features of the autumn statement were the big revisions to CGNCR, not just in the kind of next fiscal year, but the years ahead. And this week's remit really didn't change those at all. You know, CGNCR is still going to be very sizable, and we're still in a period of very large redemptions for the next few fiscal years. So what we're talking about is not just one more year of very heavy gilt supply. You know, next year's gross gilt supply will now be up by 12% versus the current fiscal year, but a sustained multi-year period of substantial gilt supply. And I think that should probably weigh on the market slightly more than it is already. Of course, like I always said, the kind of overall gilt number was perhaps unlikely to be the most important element. So the other thing that we were watching closely was the skew of that issuance across the curve. We were, like I said, in line with consensus and expecting that to be skewed shorter. And that was what materialized. But I think my takeaway again here would be to focus less on those proportional sizes of the buckets, because of course, you know, if we're talking about a, you know, scenario of a lack of demand at the long end, for the DMO to be cutting that bucket proportionally sounds like good news. But actually, when we look at the nominal amount of issuance at the long end of the curve, that's essentially going to be in line with what we saw in this current fiscal year, which marks a major step up from what we were used to in the kind of pre-COVID years. You know, pre-COVID, that long bucket used to be on average sort of 30 to 35 billion, let's say. And it's now just shy of 50 billion projected to be next year, which once you reallocate some of that unallocated bucket, puts it, at least probably at 50 billion. So it's a huge step up in long supply against a backdrop of very little demand for long end bonds in the UK. And I think that ultimately should probably weigh on the curve a little bit more than it has already. I think, you know, we saw a flattening of the curve that was kind of welcoming this shift shorter in the buckets, but that misses the overall point, I think, that actually nominal long end gilt supply is going to be very heavy. And the other takeaway that I guess just adds a little bit of impetus to that curve steepening bias that the extra or the additional long end supply adds is that the DMO kept the proportion of the shorts bucket very similar. So of course, that means a small increase in short supply in nominal terms, given that it's the same proportion of a larger number. And most of the additional issuance that came from the longs bucket went to the mediums. I think part of the reason why they did that was to avoid adding to an already heavy redemption profile over the next couple of years. But I do think that probably the bigger step up in demand that we've seen in the UK, you know, in part replacing some of that lost real money demand at the long end, has been at the front end of the curve. And so, you know, over 2023, for example, we saw domestic bank treasuries by close to 40 billion of sub-5-year bonds in the UK, of sub-5-year gilt, sorry. Whereas the step up in the issuance profile was much smaller than that, just 10 billion. So, and domestic bank treasuries historically have been net sellers of gilt. So I think that this is probably a relatively positive story for front end yields in the near term, as I think there's enough demand to kind of offset that very small step up in supply. And at the same time, we're in, you know, a point in the monetary policy pricing cycle, let's say, where it feels like we've priced out, you know, we've almost gone too far in pricing out that dovish reaction function, and now pricing at the very hawkish end of what I would say was a reasonable range. So overall, I think the curve should steepen, although I'm aware that that has been a relatively popular view at different points this year and perhaps hasn't played out in the way that some would be expecting.
And I suppose in terms of the Bank of England, do you think there's any implications there? What do you think it means for them?
The short answer is not really, I guess. You know, when we look at the degree of easing that was announced in this budget. It's actually smaller than what was announced in the autumn statement back in November last year. And the kind of headline measure, that 2p cut of national insurance, was exactly the same as the cut in national insurance that was announced in the autumn statement. And at that time, the Bank of England judged this to be a broadly neutral policy measure, i.e., there was an increase in demand, but an offsetting increase in on the supply side as well. So I find it difficult to imagine that they would judge this to have an especially different impact on growth or inflation just a couple of months later. Maybe at the margin, the fact that it was, an expansionary fiscal budget maybe reinforces our view that the Bank of England might cut slightly later than was previously expected. But our August base case for the first cut is now very close to what markets are expecting. And of course, to think about this year's fiscal expansion in isolation is to miss the kind of multi-year period of fiscal contraction that will then follow, which will also matter for the Bank of England and the way that they see growth and inflation evolving over the next couple of years. But the short answer is that I don't think it moves the needle all that much for the Bank of England in the near term. They're the overriding influential factor about, when they cut rates and how much they cut rates by will be about their assessment of the labour market and wage inflation, I think. And we didn't learn a whole lot about that this week. Okay, that's probably enough from me. Jan, let's switch over to the US. Thank you for joining us, because I know we are recording this right as Powell is giving his semi-annual testimony in front of Congress. Do you want to just talk a little bit about what your key takeaways are from what he said already today and what he said yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this time around, we didn't really get too much on monetary policy. Maybe he will have something. We're recording, actually. We stepped away to record as he's kind of preparing some of his opening remarks for in front of Senate today. But the first is the House. Typically, the questions tend to be a little bit harder during the in front of the Senate as opposed to House of Representatives. A lot of the questions were centered around bank regulation, so things like the Basel III endgame. It was pretty repetitive on that front. Of course, election year influences can tee up some of these questions as well. So he didn't say all that much new. Maybe the one thing that we got from the statement, the prepared remarks, was that the message that cuts are coming this year. They don't want to be too fast. They don't want to be too slow. So I guess that's not really a new message, but reinforcing the message that the next move is a cut. There has been some discussion in popular media about, what if there's a X percent chance of a hike, let alone no cut? We look at those in a pretty far-fetched way, and I think Powell has made it pretty clear that the next move is going to be a cut, not a hike. And so I'm not going to be able to give you something too exciting about the semi-annual testimony. It's definitely a kind of a grueling 2-day process for the chair. And, so far, I think the message is consistent that should data continue the way it is, I guess January data not so much, but generally if data continues in this kind of decelerating trend, cuts will come, we think, as soon as middle of this year.
I like you've drawn the short straw a little bit this week, having to record not only when Powell's giving his testimony, but of course, 24 hours ahead of NFPs, as usual, on one Thursday every month for you. I guess, without being too prescriptive about exactly what the number might be, given most listeners will have learned that already by the time they're listening, maybe you can just talk through, how much you think tomorrow might matter for the Fed and what kind of a number you think might be most important.
I actually think it matters a lot in a sense that last month was a very, very strong payroll number. The jobs added were over 300,000. We accelerated the pace. The 3-month average picked up. So for me, and the most important thing from this meeting in my mind will be the Fed's forecast that we get, right? Like the what's called the SCP, where we will also see what the FOMC officials see as the appropriate stance for rate cuts this year, next year, and so on. So last time around, so that's in December, the median dot, as we call them, forecasted or showed 75 basis point of cuts. However, we only need two officials to shift their expectations higher, so assume only 50 basis points of cuts instead of 75, and the median would shift to 50. So I think if we don't get a weak number tomorrow, that might be sufficient to tip the balance. Of course, we'll have the CPI before the meeting as well, but still, I think it would be well justified to say, to, you know, all else equal, adjust your expectations that fewer cuts are necessary. Again, this doesn't mean we're going to be hiking or holding. They just say they maybe push back their cut start by a quarter or something like that. So for markets, I think that will be impactful. One of our frameworks we mentioned here before too. Maybe I mention this every week, and I say we've mentioned it before, but the whole markets anchoring around these forecasts, right? So we struggled to get past 75 basis points of cuts for this year. So what I mean is, when we sell off, the market pretty much gets a powerful resistance around the Fed's forecasts, and it's rare to the situation where markets will assume that the Fed's going to be more hawkish than what they say is pretty rare. And that means when we had a kind of like this runaway inflation in 2022 for a little bit, we saw those dynamics, but that hasn't been the case at all. If they shift their forecast higher, I think you kind of have to reprice a little bit the front end as well, just to kind of, you know, the probability of distributions have shift at that point. So I think we will get that pricing immediately after NFPs. And, you know, like a strong surprise, upside surprise, I think would equate to something along the lines of 12 to 15 basis points of, you know, I'm picking very precise numbers, but just to kind of give like a middle of, you know, what a single hike would look like. So shift that kind of like in the forward pricing for the end of this year. And I think that's how you kind of translate the rest of it to the curve. Our expectation is not that we think we will see a payback for January strong numbers. We're looking for 175K in non-farm payrolls, unemployment rate to tick up to 3.8%. So if we get that, I think the December forecast still remain, you know, not stale, and they can still go with 75 basis points of cuts. And that's a thing, obviously supportive for markets. I don't know how much more than, you know, like a beat, but it's definitely supportive for rates.
Okay. I guess this is somewhat implicit a little bit in what you've already said then, but we've talked a lot on this pod in the last couple of weeks about your curve view. And I kind of referenced earlier that I felt like the steepener was a popular but painful trade in the UK. And perhaps it's been similar across global fixed income. Would you share that assessment in the US?
It really is. I mean, you know, whoever you talk to, most of our client interactions, everyone is on board with the idea of a curve steepener. It makes sense in this environment where you have rates at relatively higher levels compared to the last decade or so. You would expect to see rallies to be, at this point in the monetary policy cycle, rallies to be driven by bull steepening. So shorter dated yields lead the path as we reprice Fed expectations. I think the very painful kind of development was towards the end of this year, we had a big rally. The curve does a parallel shift lower. That is pretty unusual in a 70 basis point rally. So the steepener didn't materialize then. Then we've even got to a point where we've been bull flattening and pretty much like bear steepening. So it's just been like a pretty tough environment for, you know, people who want to have like a long to steepener exposure. I think, how does that change? I mean, I think either you kind of get to a point where something has to pretty much not melt down or collapse, but, you know, you have like an event that triggers a Fed to move pretty fast. But we, like I've mentioned before, we don't really have too much desire to own longer dated paper here. The front end makes sense. And interestingly, I was looking, you know, we go into this year in a year ahead, when we prepared our year ahead notes and, you know, like outlooks, we had the view of, you know, like the steepener makes sense, put it in forward space. And I was just tracking the performance of each of the legs the other day, and kind of, you know, the interesting thing is a lot of people are hesitant to put on the steepener because of the negative carry. And a negative carry is largely driven by the shorter dated leg having, you know, the shorter part of the curve being so inverted between funding and let's say like the 2 year part. But actually the outright long in twos, called from mid November, would have performed well. You would have made, even including the negative carry. What you didn't make on was the the long end where we just kind of saw like that part of the curve rallying. So like you didn't get the steepening from that. So that's a interesting way to look at it. It wasn't the carry, it was kind of like the directionality of the curve that really didn't make the trade work. We still think it works out, but it does feel like there's a lot of people who are unable to, you know, maintain this position. I mean, it's just like a slow drag. It's not working out. And, you know, I think position is going to clear out certainly a lot more in that steepener trade over the coming weeks if anything doesn't change. And, you know, even for us, like we're kind of looking at our trade discussions and things like that, and that's kind of sounds like a sore spot. So, which means that probably as soon as we kind of say that we're going more neutral on the curve, then the curve is going to, you know, ballistically steepen. And so watch out for that.
Classic. Of course it will. All right. Thank you both for sharing your thoughts with me this week. Thank you to our listeners for listening in. Just a reminder, if you liked today's episode, please don't forget to hit the like button and click subscribe so you can get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. Thanks. See you next week.